Hi, it's Mountain Edition. All the news from the week here in the Roaring Fork Valley coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Wyatt Orm.
This week we'll talk about medical aid in dying in Colorado, which is now an option for Valley residents. Also, two congressional Democrats want to see more wilderness along the Continental Divide. And the outdoor industry wants to learn from tribal leaders in a meeting scheduled for the summer.
And the finalists for the Wheeler restaurant space have been revealed. A few local favorites did not make the cut. Also, the X Games are in town, and some athletes are talking with local students about bullying.
The biggest stories from this week coming up on Mountain Edition.
There are six candidates for three open seats on Basalt's town council. Ryan Slack, Carol Hawk, Todd Hartley, Bill Infante, and incumbents Gary Tenenbaum and Bernie Grauer all submitted completed packets this week. In Carbondale, there are five seats opening up. Current Mayor Dan Richardson will run for mayor again, unopposed. Five candidates will compete for the four other seats. Three incumbents, Luis Yanez, Erica Sparhawk, and Heather Henry. The other two are April Spaulding and Lonnie Kitching. The election's on April 3rd.
Colorado Senator Michael Bennett and Representative Jared Polis announced a bill yesterday that would designate new wilderness in the White River National Forest.
Elizabeth Stewart-Sevry reports.
The bill would create protections for nearly 100,000 acres in the White River National Forest along the Continental Divide. It would expand the Holy Cross Wilderness area in Eagle County and create new designated wilderness in the 10-mile range west of Breckenridge. There are two new wildlife conservation areas included in the measure as well. It would also make the 10th Mountain Division training site at Camp Hale the country's first National Historic Landscape. Polis and Bennett say this would both preserve an important historical landmark and protect the surrounding ecosystem. The bill has support from commissioners in Eagle, Summit, and Grand counties, as well as from local environmental groups. It was introduced in both chambers of Congress. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
The Wheeler Restaurant Review Committee has selected four finalists to operate the city dining space within the Wheeler Opera House.
Allison Bechtesh reports.
Current tenant Justice Snows did not make the cut, nor did locals' favorites Aspen Over Easy or Jimmy's. Remaining are proposals from businesses Hayden's Limited, Mr. Gray LLC, Elk Mountain Ventures, and Highlands Restaurant Group. The full scope of their proposals are not public during this stage of the review process, but Assistant City Manager Sarah Ott says the selection committee evaluated all proposals based on the viability of a successful year-round restaurant that catered to locals.
We heard loud and clear from the community that there's an interest in breakfast. So we're trying to see what we can do to continue to provide a vibrant restaurant scene that meets the community's and our visitors' desires.
Rent profits from the restaurant will go to city arts programming. The selection committee is expected to present their recommendation to City Council on February 26th. Allison Bechtesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
This week, Aspen City Council gave the go-ahead on two private leases on public land at Cozy Point Ranch. Aspen Tree, a local agriculture and education operation, will lease 14 acres, and Cozy Point Equestrian Facility will continue to operate on 27 acres. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy is here to talk details. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Wyatt.
So what's the plan for these new leases?
Well, the equestrian operation will be much the same. They board horses and have other equestrian programming, including the high school equestrian team, but there will be growth and change on the agriculture side. Aspen Tree operates now at Cozy Point Ranch on just a half an acre, and Ed Invardi, who heads up Aspen Tree, calls it a farm park. So they have farm animals, education programs, they sell eggs and other products at local farmers markets, and they host a really popular community dinner around Thanksgiving.
Okay.
So all of that's going to continue, but it will grow. The new lease is for 14 acres, and Vardy has big plans for sustainable agriculture and education. He plans to expand the food production, and perhaps the biggest change is that they want to build a $5 million facility called the Farm Center. That's going to include a classroom, a community commercial kitchen for kind of local food startups, and also a store for local foods. So Aspen Tree is in the process of raising money right now for that facility. And as Vardy pointed out to council, all of this is a significant investment for them in the property.
So Aspen Tree will add all this infrastructure, but it's public property. So what are the terms of the lease?
It's essentially a 20-year lease. And this may sound like a long time, but Vardy was actually asking council for more guarantees that he'll be able to operate long term. He says it takes at least 15 years to see a return on the investments that he put in, not just that $5 million farm center, but also it takes time to regenerate the soil for things like fruit trees to become established and for a healthy ecosystem.
Huh.
So Vardy asked council to actually revisit the lease and give some other options, and they weren't supportive of extending the lease beyond the kind of 20-year period.
Okay, so what was the mood like at the council meeting?
Vardy has tons of support from the community. The council chambers were packed with parents and kids who use and love Aspen Tree now and want to see it grow. And council showed support as well, though Mayor Steve Skadron did raise a philosophical question, asking if these type of leases represent the commercialization of public lands. And this is not the only open space property in the valley that's being used for agricultural purposes. Pitkin County has several open space properties with agricultural leases as well. So this question of what we do with our open spaces is something the community will certainly have to continue to wrestle with. For now, council advised staff to move forward with these leases, and it will be back in front of council in February.
All right. Thank you, Elizabeth.
You bet.
Republicans are moving forward with a bill to set aside annual money for roads and bridges, heading on a collision course with Democrats and the governor, who aren't on board with the measure.
As Benta Berkland reports, it's a far cry from the last session when a bipartisan agreement appeared close.
In 2017, legislative leaders in the House and Senate and the governor all backed a plan to send a sales tax increase to voters for transportation funding. But it was ultimately defeated in the GOP-controlled Senate, even though the chamber's president, Kevin Grantham, was the main sponsor.
I was willing to look at the path of going to the voters on a tax increase. It wasn't very popular in my caucus, that's for sure.
This year, Grantham's in line with his party and opposes any new taxes. Instead, he and other Republicans want to set aside a budget surplus of about $300 million for roads and bridges to pay off bonds. Voters would still need to approve a ballot question to issue bonds for some of the major projects along I-25 and I-70.
This is about taking something that everybody says they want accomplished. And instead of putting it at the bottom of the list and leaving the leftovers and the crumbs for transportation, let's put it at the top of the list.
Three state agencies testified against the measure during its first hearing. The Colorado Department of Corrections, Human Services, and Higher Education all say locking the state into long-term bond payments could impact their budgets down the line.
This bill would create a level of uncertainty in general fund dollar availability and squeeze our agency's ability to just provide very basic services.
Christine Rosendahl is with the Department of Corrections. She says the agency gets about 90% of its budget from the state. With her caseloads growing, she wants to see more flexibility and worries about what would happen in an economic downturn.
Our existence and continued funding is imperative to protect people and individuals within the public from harm.
The Department of Higher Education's Tyler Mounsey also opposes the measure. He testified that if money is locked into law for transportation and there's a recession, higher education is likely to face cuts.
This will then cause possibly tuition to increase, and that will ultimately impact not only the institutions that we represent, there's 31 of them, but also students and their families who will have the burden of all that increased tuition.
Some Republicans on the Transportation Committee appeared frustrated at the pushback. Here's an exchange between Mounsey and Senator Ray Scott of Grand Junction.
Just out of curiosity, what's the department, what have your discussions you've all had, what do you look as a solution for transportation?
In the Department of Higher Education?
I mean, since you guys are concerned about money maybe going away, have you had any discussions about what you guys think is to help solve the problem? Where would that money come from?
We haven't had those conversations at this time, but I'm happy to do so and get back to you.
Okay, it would be helpful if you guys gave us solutions instead of roadblocks.
All of this is in sharp contrast from last session, when Democratic Speaker of the House, Chrisanta Duran, and Senate President Kevin Grantham co-sponsored legislation that would have sent that tax increase to voters. Duran still favors that approach.
If we're going to be serious about ensuring that there is a statewide plan, and I am concerned mostly about some of those communities in rural Colorado.
Duran says she wants to wait until the state's next economic forecast in March to see just how much she'd be willing to set aside for transportation. Right now, as the bill stands, it's likely to be defeated when it gets to the House. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Wyatt Orme.
And I'm Kristen Kay. And whether you're a longtime resident here in the Roaring Fork Valley or a fresh face, an employer or an employee, you know that housing is an issue that affects all of us.
Aspen Public Radio invites you to our second town hall in a series on housing issues in the Roaring Fork Valley. We'll facilitate a panel discussion about what cities and towns can do to help with the housing crunch.
Join us at the Belly Up on February 7th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. Doors open at 5:30, and we'll save some time for audience conversation following the panel discussion.
And we want your voice to be part of this conversation. Are you an employer who struggles to find qualified workers because of housing? Do you have friends or family who have had to move away because of the costs here?
To share your perspective, send an email to news@aspenpublicradio.org with the subject line Town Hall, or find out more at our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
We look forward to seeing you there.
The 2018 Outdoor Retailer and Snow Show kicks off today in Denver. It's a major convention for the outdoor industry. When the snow melts, the industry will gather again in Colorado, this time with tribal leaders.
Elizabeth Stewart-Severy reports.
This weekend's gathering is the first outdoor retailer show since the organization left Utah in protest of the state representative's stances on public lands issues. Denver will be home to all three of the outdoor retailer trade shows, including a winter market in November and a summer market this July. That's when Colorado's Outdoor Recreation Office and the Commission of Indian Affairs will host a summit of tribal leaders. 48 tribes call Colorado home, and the state says this summit will offer a chance for Native communities to have a say in a larger discussion about recreation and public lands. Colorado Lieutenant Governor Donna Lynn is chair of the Commission of Indian Affairs. Her office says the summit will cover economic development, cultural revitalization, and management of public lands. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
The X Games begin today at Buttermilk. Among the spectators will be nearly 300 students for Shred Hate Kids Day. Shred Hate is an anti-bullying campaign ESPN launched last year. The students will watch the Special Olympics Unified Slalom event and hear from several of the athletes about their own experiences with bullying. Earlier this week, X Games host Brandon Graham and ESPN's Victoria Arlen visited Riverside and Rifle Middle Schools to encourage kids to choose kindness.
Coloradans with terminal illnesses have the option to end their own lives. This became law last year, and Aspen Valley Hospital recently opted in to Proposition 106, the End of Life Options Act. Reporter Allison Bektesh attended a talk this week about seeking medical aid in dying, and she's here with me now. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Kristen.
So tell us what this bill allows.
So beginning last year, certain patients are now able to request a prescription from their doctor that ends their life. Lori Malloy, who led Aspen Valley Hospital's team through the opt-in process, wanted to make clear right away that this is not suicide. In suicide, that person wants to die even if it's a rash decision. It's usually violent and alone. With medical aid in dying, it's a patient who really wants to live, but they have this terminal illness and they're suffering. It's a long process, very thought out, involves family, doctors, and ideally those loved ones are there supporting you during a gentle dying process. To be eligible, you have to ask twice, 15 days apart, and submit a form to the state. You must be a Colorado resident, have a prognosis of 6 months or less, and be able to self-administer the drug and go under two mental health screenings. These restrictions mean ALS patients who are losing agility don't qualify, nor do those with severe dementia, even if they have provisions in their wills that they'd want this to be administered if these situations arose. The bill also allows any medical professional to recuse themselves, and medical facilities can choose to opt out altogether, which is what Aspen Valley Hospital did initially this time last year.
So this presentation you went to covered Proposition 106, but obviously there's other end-of-life options. How do they all work together?
Right. The big takeaway is talk about death. Have that conversation. Nearly 70% of people say they want to die at home, and yet 70% of people die in some form of institution, a hospital, or assisted living. The two things that came up at the talk were hospice and palliative care. They're both great assistants in end of life. One is specifically meant for the last 6 months of life, which matches exactly with one of those criteria for receiving the medication. They both aim to support the patient and ease pain, as well as some economic and sociological issues that come up. At the talk, they gave out real forms you can talk to your loved ones about, with questions like, what fears do you have about getting sick or end-of-life treatment? If you're not able to do your loved activities, would you want to stay alive? And how important is it to be at home when you die? Most likely, it would be a hospice team that is there for patients who choose this method and want to pass away at home. And while they're meant to be there for the final 6 months of life, about a third of patients on hospice die in their first week. So using these options sooner allows for these conversations and those connections so that you really have medical support around you at this time.
So what does this mean now that Aspen Valley Hospital allows this?
So what we have to look at is states that have had this legal longer than us. It's not usually a hospital thing. Oregon has had legal aid in dying the longest, 17 years. In that time, 1,000 prescriptions have been written total. And I just want to point out that a lot of times people will fill that prescription and then not choose to die that way. They just want to know that they have that option. In that time, those 1,000 prescriptions, one patient has died in a hospital. Again, most people want to die at home, and that's where they end up using those pills. The Aspen Valley Hospital policy is that you must already have the prescription and be admitted to the hospital for a medical emergency. They now have a trained team who will be there with you. In this first year, there have been 3 prescriptions written for this pill. No pharmacy in Aspen carries the drug. You have to order it. Other statistics that we've seen is that usually people who go through with this are white, highly educated. The majority of patients are cancer patients, with ALS being the second most common. Another interesting portion of the bill that seems pertinent to our area is that it's illegal to go through with this on federal property, like a national forest.
So how are medical providers reacting to this change?
At Aspen Valley Hospital, Malloy said not a single doctor, nurse, pharmacist, technician, housekeeper has to be involved if they don't want to be. They have trained staff members who volunteer to be part of this team. Marky Butler is on the board of hospice of the Rocky Mountains and runs Hospice of the Valley. They have chosen what they call a neutral position to support the patient's decision. They've resolved to keep on as clients someone who is pursuing this. In other states, there's policies where you could be discharged and no longer under care because the hospice is morally against this. She says her staff also got the option to opt out, but that every single one of them expressed interest in supporting their patients if that choice is made. They will not be in the room. That could be illegal, but will be there to help shortly after.
All right. Thank you, Allison.
Thanks, Kristen.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Wyatt Orm.
And I'm Kristen Kay. In other Aspen Public Radio news, women's marches were back last weekend in places like London, Washington, D.C., and the Roaring Fork Valley.
We talked to the Aspen Hope Center, who cautions that social media is a serious mental health stressor for teens.
The Eagle Mine Superfund site outside of Minturn is being eyed for housing developments.
And the Carbondale Board of Trustees discuss whether or not to officially allow people to drink alcohol in the street during First Fridays this summer.
Those stories and more news are on our website now. Take a listen at aspenpublicradio.org.
Wilderness Workshop has joined a lawsuit challenging the drilling of more than 100 natural gas wells near Paonia.
Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports.
The Carbondale-based environmental group joins 5 other organizations representing farmers, property owners, and recreationalists in opposing the Bull Mountain oil and gas development. They contend that the Bureau of Land Management did not fully consider the project's impacts. The proposed wells are 30 miles northeast of Paonia, within the headwaters of the North Fork of the Gunnison River. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
The rainbow flags of Aspen Gay Ski Week have come down, but as Allison Bechtesh reports, they'll be flying high again come summer.
Aspen Out is a philanthropic nonprofit that has hosted Aspen Gay Ski Week for 41 years. And for the first time, the group will hold a summer counterpart. The proceeds of the event are used for grants worldwide, including supporting LGBT programming for area youth. Adventure Out activities will include outdoor recreation like rafting, as well as concerts and parties. The inaugural Adventure Out runs July 4th through July 8th. Allison Bechtesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
Fewer Coloradans enrolled in Obamacare this past year, which was to be expected. They had less time to do it. The Trump administration trimmed the enrollment window from 3 months to 45 days. But Colorado has its own exchange, Connect for Health Colorado. Unlike many other states, it was able to extend its enrollment window to 73 days. More than 165,000 Coloradans enrolled. Last year, 172,000 signed up.
Dr. Melanie Armstrong teaches environmental policy and history at Western State Colorado University. She was in the Roaring Fork Valley last week as a part of the Naturalist Nights Environmental Speaker Series and talked to Elizabeth Stewart Savory about her presentation, Nature Should Be Free.
The title refers to graffiti she saw after the 2013 government shutdown. Armstrong says she loves the ambiguity in the statement.
Are they talking about nature should be free like it shouldn't cost money, or nature should be free like it should be open to everyone?
So this question of access to public lands is a pretty hot topic in Colorado right now. And here in the Roaring Fork Valley, we actually have two different permitting processes that the U.S. Forest Service is undertaking. Can you speak to how we can find a balance between protecting these public spaces and also allowing people to access them? Does permitting discourage use?
I think we tend to look at permitting as the best tool that we have available to us. And my hope is that when permitting comes into conversations, that it's always accompanied by thoughtful consideration, both of communities and user groups.
We sit in the middle of all this public land in the Roaring Fork Valley. And I'm wondering what advice or comments you have for people who have relatively easy access to public lands as we think about this issue as a nation. What's our role here?
I think being able to communicate value of public lands to diverse audiences is becoming ever more critical. It's not going to be enough to just convince your local community of the value of what's around you. And if you're talking to, you know, someone in Greeley who's dealing with oil rigs being built, you know, in their backyard, they certainly understand that same type of question about land nearby and land use and wanting to have some say in what your neighborhood looks like.
For a lot of environmentalists and recreationalists, it feels like we're in a time of attack on public lands. As you look at this from a historical perspective, is this unprecedented? Are we in a time of crisis about public lands?
There's definitely changes afoot. I think that these are the questions that get not just to public lands, but get to what we want as a democracy, what we want as citizens. And maybe those of us who see ourselves as environmentalists could seize that opportunity to say, this fight is about the environment, but it's also about so much more.
Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Melanie Armstrong teaches environmental policy at Western State Colorado University.
Parts of the West, including Colorado, are experiencing one of the driest and warmest winters on record. The snowpack is far below normal levels in the southern Rocky Mountains, leaving some to worry about this year's water supply.
As Luke Runyon reports, one dry winter can have far-reaching effects.
To get a sense of this year's snowpack, you need to head to a place like Berthoud Pass. It's an hour drive into the mountains west of Denver. But that's just the beginning of the journey. You still need to strap on a pair of snowshoes and hike up a hill. It's early in the morning, and because the pass is so high, I'm literally inside a cloud.
This is at the higher range of where we do measure snow. We're well over 11,000 feet here.
Carl Wetlaufer is with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Snow Survey Office. We finally come to a clearing home to a snowtell site, basically a Rube Goldberg setup of meters and tubes to measure the weight of the snow. The process is mostly automated, but the sites still require maintenance.
There's kind of some elegance in the simplicity we're literally just weighing the snowpack secondhand, and that's the most accurate way to get the water content.
It's all meant to give a glimpse at how the winter is shaping up, so cities, farmers, and water managers all throughout the West can plan. So far, the prognosis isn't great.
Just driving up through the mountains as we gain elevation, there's definitely noticeably less snowpack than we would expect as we approach the site. And intuitively, you can just feel that we do have a lower snowpack.
That's even worse news considering Berthoud Pass is one of the better sites for snowpack in the entire Colorado River watershed, which supplies water for some 40 million people in seven states. Jeff Lucas studies long-term climate shifts at the Western Water Assessment, based at the University of Colorado Boulder.
The hole that we're in now in terms of the snow deficit is going to be really hard to pull out of.
He says if you add up the numbers at all the snowtell sites in the upper Colorado River, snowpack is at 63% of average. It's well below normal, and we're now halfway through the snow season. So if things stay dry through the spring, Lucas says it'll set the stage for the rest of the year.
You have vegetation growing and drying out and curing earlier. You're setting yourself up for a worse than average wildfire season.
Forecasts for river flows by the Colorado Basin River Forecast Center are already taking the current snowpack into account. Most streams are projected to be lower this spring, some just slightly, with others extremely below average.
So we can weather one bad year, but in other parts of the West or even downstream in the Colorado River Basin, Lakes Powell and Meade are both sitting, you know, well below capacity.
Which means downstream states like Arizona are anxiously looking toward the Rocky Mountains. The Colorado River, fed by snowmelt, provides roughly 40% of the state's water.
We closely watch this. We know how important it is.
Tom Bouchotsky is director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources.
And it's a huge piece of Arizona's water budget and a lifeblood for the state.
And the state isn't even close to recovering from a long-term drought that's plagued the Southwest for more than a decade now. How worried are you, would you say, from like a scale of zero being we're doing great, we've got plenty of water, to 10 being we are in panic mode?
I am probably at about a 7 right now.
Does any of that keep you up at night, or do you sleep pretty well?
Most nights it does not keep me up. There's an occasional night where it does.
22.5.
Depth, 22.5.
Back at Berthoud Pass, snow surveyor Carl Wetlaufer writes down measurements using an aluminum tube to weigh the snow. This more old-school way of measurement is still in use by surveyors across the West.
Let me just hang this off a ski pole so we can get a nice stable measurement from it.
Wetlaufer isn't panicking yet. There's still plenty of winter ahead of us. And it wouldn't be unprecedented for some big storms to change everything. But the window for those Hail Mary snowstorms is closing.
And yeah, with every week that goes by, the probability of reaching a normal snowpack just gets less and less, really.
And that's exacerbated by the current long-term weather forecasts. They're showing a likely chance of higher temperatures and lower precipitation this spring in places that need exactly the opposite. I'm Luke Runyon.
This story was produced in partnership with public media station KUNC in Northern Colorado, with financial support by the Walton Family Foundation.
That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Wyatt Orm. You can find more news from the Roaring Fork Valley and from around the world on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune into Valley Roundup tomorrow at 3:30. This week, Wyatt, you're taking a deep dive into the headlines with local reporters and columnists.
Yeah, we're going to talk about DACA. We're talking about Aspen Valley Hospital opting into Colorado's Right to Die legislation and local athletes competing here at home in the X Games.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.